It's time for the one show that takes you where others won't, out into the wilderness, past the frontiers of what you thought was possible, with your own personal guide, the Pilgrim on the 405, Will Crist.
Well, welcome to Pilgrim Talks on this nice, comfortable, not a cloud in the sky day in Laguna Beach. There are times when we want to talk about what's going on in the business world, and there's certainly a perspective that CEOs have of the business world. At the same time, there are perspectives that service providers, first-class service providers, bring because they see a larger picture. They tend to look across various businesses. They tend to see what's going on, different patterns. And when they see those patterns, based upon their experience, they can give advice, they can make suggestions, can help CEOs get beyond the kind of narrow vision that maybe their experience has left them with. One of those people is somebody who's very, very experienced in corporate and securities practice at Stradling, Yaka, Carlson, and Roth. Chris Ivey has been involved with businesses since he left Cal State University Long Beach in 1990. He's a member of the Bar of California. He's done a lot of work in Orange County. So I want to welcome Chris Ivey to the radio show to talk a little bit about what he sees in business today. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Chris Ivey and Stradling.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'll give you the overview. I've been practicing law at Stradling, Yaka, Carlson, Routh for 17 years, and I'm co-chair of our corporate and securities department. And Stradling, Yaka is a firm that really grew up with Orange County. It started in Orange County back in 1974 when the county was, you know, pretty nascent from a business development perspective. And it started as a firm that was really focused on working with young companies, emerging growth companies, and really being a business boutique firm that was really practical in the application of law. And it's really grown from there as the county has grown, so that the practice is somewhat reflective of Southern California and Orange County in particular. We're about over 100 attorneys, and many of us are here. We have offices in San Diego, Santa Barbara, and Santa Monica as well. And like I said, I'm part of the corporate practice, so my practice is focused on financings and M&A and general day-to-day corporate work, both private and public companies.
Well, tell us a little bit about what you see going on in the business world today.
Well, that's a pretty broad question. I guess we could start with, you know, kind of entrepreneurs here in Orange County. Since that's such a vibrant part of the county and really a significant piece of the continued economic development of the county. So should we start there?
That would sound like a good place to start.
Excellent. Well, you know, Orange County really is a hotbed for entrepreneurs and a lot of startup companies, emerging growth companies. And Orange County has continued to facilitate and support the growth of those types of companies, partly relating to the talent pool that we have in Orange County and the professional services also in that area, and financing. There's been, a little bit of, Orange County is a little bit behind, frankly, when compared to areas like Silicon Valley and maybe even some areas like Austin or Boston on the East Coast. As far as having homegrown funding sources for those types of companies, venture capital funds. You know, we have a handful of those funds here, but you know, that's an area where we lag a little bit. And I think there are people out there that are trying to increase the prevalence of venture capital money in the area, but most of the venture capital money actually that comes into Orange County is from outside geographic regions. But as far as that's concerned and fundraising is concerned in general, which I said is really, I think, the engine that drives a lot of those companies, there's been a lot of hesitancy to fund new startups in the technology space in particular. although there are some areas that are exceptions to that. A medical device continues to get a fair amount of attention, and clean tech type of companies continue to get a fair amount of attention. But it's difficult. The fundraising environment is difficult. Many of the VC firms that invested, five plus years or so ago, haven't had the exits that they would have otherwise expected to have had. And because of the lack of those exits, whether it's through an initial public offering or through a sale of the company, because of the lack of those exits, it's been more difficult to raise capital for those funds, and they've been more hesitant to put money to work. It's something that the county is working on. There are some groups. There's a new group called K5 that's been launched by some local angels, if you will. When I refer to angels, I'm meaning funding sources that are pre-venture capital, but individuals who fund companies after a friends and family type of round of financing that are trying to develop organizations to fund startups and give them guidance, some initial capital and some guidance to kind of get to that next level so they can get venture capital money and get to a more mature state so that they'll attract venture capital. So there's a lot of activity in that area, but it's still a difficult environment.
Well, tell us a little bit about K5.
Well, K5 it's just recently been launched, just in November. In fact, I'm not even sure that they're accepting applications yet. Well, but they've got their Facebook page launched and their website. But it's an organization that would be referred to as either a launch pad or an accelerator, which is a group of individuals that have put some money into a pool. They look at companies who apply to provide them support both on the professional service side and from the operations side, and puts a minimal amount of funding into the companies. And really the purpose of it, as I understand it, is really to test some very early stage companies to validate whether their business plan or their product is worthy of pursuing and getting it to the next level. And obviously their objective, this kind of plays into what we just talked about with respect to entrepreneurs in Orange County and supporting entrepreneurship in Orange County. That's one of their goals. So they put in a minimum amount of funding and give them some of that support to help grow local companies to get them to the next level. So hopefully, I think the objective for that, the program also will, as I understand it, is they take companies in for, it's basically a three-month program. And that's when they get this guidance from both the associated professional service firms and the individuals that provide the business guidance. And it's an intensive three-month process to determine whether some of these businesses are worth taking to the next level. But their intent is to run hundreds of companies through the program. So that adds, hopefully, to the vitality of the entrepreneur environment in Orange County.
So that's at K5Launch.com, right?
Correct.
And tell us a little bit about Ray Chan and what are Ray's thoughts about this?
Well, Ray has been associated with the Tech Coast Angels for many years and participates in investing in local companies at the angel level and on some occasions even taking management positions with those companies that he invests in. And Ray, along with others who are starting K5 Launch, saw really that gap, the fact that there's a need for these smaller companies to get this additional guidance and really to try to bring Orange County to the next level from a from the perspective of supporting young businesses and entrepreneurship. So, you know, I think Ray's objective is to make Orange County a little more competitive, if you will, with areas like the Silicon Valley and in Austin, Texas, and the Boston area.
But Ray's been a great somebody looking for that assistance. Might go to k5launch.com, take a look at it.
Yeah, that would be great, and I'm sure Ray would appreciate that, you know, having exposure to additional people that are interested in finding more about K5.
Excellent. Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Now, do you work with startups and entrepreneurs?
I do, and our firm does. I mean, that's really our bread and butter. We work both with private and public companies, but we start with companies really from their very early stages. It could be, you know, way back when AST Computer was founded, with Safi Qureshi in his garage, that was a straddling client, so that you give you some history. And we still do that type of thing, working with companies at their very early stages, and I'm talking at the stage of formation. And then working with them throughout their life cycle, if you will, from their first financing to venture capital financing and private equity, if that's appropriate, and to a public offering, if they get there. That market, you know, that's another topic. That market has been substantially unavailable for most companies. There are a handful of companies that are able to get there. But, yeah, we work with early-stage companies really at all levels. And our objective is similar to what, you know, the objective of the individuals involved in K5 Launch is to facilitate those companies best we can, be very practical in our advice, and be, you know, to some extent we're business counselors as much as we are legal counselors because we do a lot of deals. We see what works and what doesn't work, and are able to often, you know, guide companies in the right direction as far as the type of financing they should be seeking, you know, the types of terms that are standard within the market that they're playing in, and that sort of thing. So that's really for us. I tell you, Will, for us, a lot of the fun is working with those companies, learning about their businesses, you know, the visions that the individuals have that start those companies, and then growing with them and being a part of their team. That's what makes what we do fun.
Well, now, is there money available? I mean, it seems to be that money is, you know, that money credit crunch is slowing a lot of people down.
Yeah. Well, I think the answer is, yes, there's money available. The follow-up question is, well, can I get it? And, you know, that's a different question. There is money available. In fact,
it's,
you know,
available,
these,
but you can't have any.
That's right. You can look at it, but you can't touch it. And then I guess the other part of that would be thinking about, well, what sources of money are available? You know, are you talking about credit through a traditional bank? Or you're talking about the things we just talked about, angel financing, or through high net worth individuals, or through venture capital funds. You know, there is money available. I think what we're dealing with, and having gone through the last couple of years, several years now, is that there's still more caution in putting that money to work. For companies who can get bank financing, a regular asset-based lending facility through a commercial bank, terms are actually pretty good. Interest rates are relatively low, and banks are willing to lend to companies that can service the debt. For companies that don't generate a lot of cash, or are, you know, technology-based companies that maybe have all of their assets in intellectual property and not hard assets that, you know, could be liquidated or used as any really firm source of collateral, it's a much different story. Bank financing is not readily available to companies like that. However, there are banks like Silicon Valley Bank that do provide financing for that type of company if their risk assessment is meets the criteria for a bank like that. But you refer to them sometimes as venture lenders. And there are all different tiers, frankly, Will, of the types of lenders that are available. It really depends on how much money you're willing to pay for that money. They can get quite expensive. But with groups like Silicon Valley Bank, who funds a lot of our clients, their terms can be very reasonable. And oftentimes then they ask for a piece of the upside through equity. Maybe they get a warrant in the company that would give them some additional kicker as far as their return on investment beyond just their interest collected on the loan. And so that's how they engage. That's their business model. The short answer to that question is, money's available. It's difficult to get if you're not generating cash sufficient to service the debt. But there are potential avenues out there through varied lenders that meet those specific needs.
And will you help an entrepreneur position him or herself to go to the right source?
Yeah, that's a great question. We often do refer clients to sources of funding. We are very careful to caveat when we meet with clients to let them know that that's not our business. Raising capital is not our business. But part of what we do and what other firms like us do that are engaged in the emerging growth company work is utilize our network as much as we can when we think it's appropriate. We obviously have to be act as a filter in some way, but when the occasion is appropriate, certainly we will refer banks or angels or venture capital firms to clients of ours for fundraising purposes. So that is something that we do, and go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask. So, what somebody out there who is an entrepreneur, looking around, got a great idea, maybe even pushed it to a place where he's bringing in some money right now. What is your target? Who should be thinking about giving you a call?
Yeah. Well, okay. That's a good question as well, because oftentimes, in particular, if you haven't done it before, it's sometimes difficult to see the value of paying legal fees when you're pinching every penny and trying to make the cash run as far as it can.
Oh, you mean you're not doing this for free?
Yeah, well, I guess some of our clients may ask us to do that, but no, that's not our business model. But we try, we try to be as flexible as we can, frankly, Will, with our clients on fees, especially in the early stages, because we know cash is king. That's what makes the companies tick. So we'll try to do some alternative arrangements here or there, or defer fees for a short period of time, until a financing. So we do try to spread that around a little bit and be as flexible as we can, still being mindful that we're running a business as well.
Mm-hmm.
But back to your earlier question, when should somebody call? I mean, it's really beneficial to make that call as early as possible. And even if it's not engaging a firm to actually provide legal services at the time, to at least talk to somebody about setting up an entity and what are the alternatives available from that perspective. What are the tax implications? How do I incentivize employees? There are a lot of initial questions protecting intellectual property. A lot of initial questions that we may at least be able to give you some guidance, even if you don't get to the stage of engaging us at that point in time. So again, it's going back to where we see ourselves and our role in the community. That's part of it. We really are intending to be supportive of the entrepreneurial community. Obviously, our objective in the end is to engage clients and continue to work with them on a fee arrangement, but happy to have preliminary calls and consultations with people that are just getting going. And
so I'm going to ask you a really tough question here.
Sure.
And you can tell me that your compliance will not let you talk about it or something like that, and I'll understand. I have heard some of my clients come back and say that, you know, even though that they were starting off, that some of the law firms they talked to, one of them charged like $700 an hour for legal advice. Now, is that what they need to be prepared to get that from you?
The rates differ for sure, depending on the firm you go to and the individual you're talking to. I mean, at a firm like ours, we don't have many people that would bill at that rate.
Okay.
But there are a lot of firms, in particular, you know, if you're going to talk to the national firms who have partners that bill at that rate or higher than that. It's not an inexpensive proposition.
Mm-hmm.
However, I would say, and maybe I'm a little bit biased in this regard, but I would say you get what you pay for. You know, if you go to a firm that has a lot of experience in doing the types of work that you need done, it's worth paying for somebody that's experienced in that space as opposed to not doing it right and having to fix it later.
Yeah.
But it, you're right, Will. It can be a shock to some people. But
yeah.
We, you know, like I said, we try to be as flexible as we can. But it can be sticker shock, you know, for if you've never gone through the process before.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So work with entrepreneurs and startups. What would be the next level of businesses that you help?
Well, you know, we go across industries, but as far as maturity, you know, entrepreneurs, startups continue, you know, through the life cycle of most of the companies we work with. I mean, if you looked at it from a financing stage perspective, you know, when you first start your company, you either fund it yourself or you get your mom and dad to help fund it, or your brother and sister, your friends and family. The next stage after that is going to angel investors or, you know, high net worth individuals, assuming that your company is not mature enough yet to go to venture capital firms. And when we talk about, you know, as far as the amount of capital that you'd be looking for, you know, venture capital firms really don't get very interested in companies that are looking to raise just, I would say, less than, you know, a couple of million dollars. And even when venture capital firms invest a couple of million dollars, they're looking at not only that investment round, but that they'll probably put more into the company in later investment rounds. And part of that is just a function of the size of some of the venture capital firms. If they have hundreds of millions of dollars to invest, they just don't have the resources to invest $500,000 or $1 million in so many companies around the country. So that's why the high net worth individuals or angel investors fit that category. And then after you get out of that category, then it's going to venture capital funds who usually invest with minority interests in companies, meaning they don't take control, per se, of the company. They may get one or two board seats on the board, but, you know, generally wouldn't have control of the board themselves. They may sit on the board with the founders and the CEO of the company and maybe some independent board members. So that would be the next stage of venture capital rounds. And you can survive, you know, from a financing perspective at the VC round for, you know, throughout the duration, really, until an exit. Because really the next stage, if you don't sell an interest to a private equity fund, either a control interest or actually sell the company, would be to the public markets. But the reality, as you probably know, and most of your listeners probably know, is that the public markets have not been available for most companies. most of the exits for companies that have financial investors has been through a sale of the company. And, you know, you have to realize when you're raising capital and asking somebody to put money into your company, their objective in the end is to get a return on their capital, which means at some point in time they're going to have liquidity. And whether that's through an IPO or a sale of the company may depend on market conditions at the time and strategic opportunities. But most of those have been through M&A, you know, sale of the company.
Now, do you help with him M&A activities? Do you help find find potential partners, suitors, purchasers?
The first part of that question, do we help in the M&A process? Definitely. I mean, that's a large portion of our practice is mergers and acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
The second part of that question, do we help find suitors, is less so. We certainly have relationships with investment banks that engage in that business. And if we know that an investment bank specializes in a particular industry and that the company that we represent engages in that industry, then we'll certainly make those connections
mm-hmm.
to an investment bank. But then it's the investment bank's job and that company's job to really find the suitors. It would be a rare occasion when we would have the opportunity to introduce two businesses that would engage in an M&A transaction.
Mm-hmm.
But we do facilitate that for sure, Will, through our relationships with investment banks, whether it's just through some of the regional investment banks or through some of the national firms that we see on mm-hmm. a lot of the deals that we do.
Yeah, well, that's good.
And
I'll be interviewing George Lanza of Plethora Businesses. He does a lot of M&A work, and it's going to be interesting to hear from him. He's telling me that he regularly gets inquiries from companies around the country, around the globe, looking specifically for companies in Southern California.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Looking just in Southern California for what reason? Because of the business climate here, or because it's actually an expensive place to do business, or for what reason?
Well, they're looking they will have a particular set of specifications for businesses that they're looking for, and it's his
yeah.
job to go out and find them.
Right.
I don't know why they're particularly coming here, but he's saying he's got a very robust business in terms of helping people find those, putting them together.
Yeah, well, I think part of the reason is back to how we started our discussion is that, you know, Southern California area is a hotbed for emerging growth companies. I mean, it doesn't compete at the same level as Silicon Valley, but it's pretty good. So there's a lot of companies here,
mm-hmm.
and you know we get actually people asking us as well and clients sometimes that will say, you know, they'll give you some parameters and maybe they're looking for, you know, businesses with at least X dollars of revenue and Y dollars of EBITDA or
mm-hmm.
income.
Precisely.
And say that, yeah, these are the types of companies that we're interested in, and these are the industries that we're interested in. You know, do you have any clients in that space that might be interested in speaking to us?
We hear that
as well.
Good. Well, listen. Can you stick around a little bit after a short break here, and we'll talk a little bit more about the upper market?
Sure, my pleasure, Will.
Hello, this is Bob Annone with Sandler Training, here to talk to you about rule number one. You have to learn to fail to win. Think about learning how to walk or riding a bike. When you first started to learn how to walk, of course you fell. And you fell again, but eventually you mastered the art of walking. Same thing with riding a bike or driving a car or making cold calls or starting up a business. Henry Ford failed 4 times before he succeeded. Thomas Edison worked almost 10 years on the light bulb before he succeeded. They weren't failures, but they were willing to risk failure to find out what they were truly capable of achieving. At Sandler, we ask you to learn from your failures and understand that the process is failing, not you as a person. You are not a failure. The process that you are using isn't apparently the right one to produce the results that you're trying to produce. So if the cold call isn't going well, we'd ask you to examine the sales process that you're using. Don't get discouraged if your sales call doesn't go well. Learn from it. So again, Sandler rule number one is you have to be willing to fail and risk failure in order to win, to find out what you're truly capable of achieving.
And now back to Will and his guest.
Well, we've been talking with Chris Ivey, partner at Stradling, one of the premier law firms in Orange County. Chris, tell us a little bit about now when a company is ready to be acquired. What steps do they take? Do they go to a business broker? What do they begin doing?
Well, it would be, at least for most of the clients that we work with, we wouldn't send them to a business broker. Business brokers usually work with much smaller companies. Mm-hmm. Usually we would advise them to speak with an investment banker with experience in the industry of that particular company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of things that they need to think about in that context when they're getting ready for an M&A transaction. You know, part of it, just from the legal perspective, is really getting their, you know, everything in order, their books and records in order, and making sure that when they present themselves to a potential buyer, or when they decide that they're going to auction off the company to as many buyers as they can to get to participate in the auction, that the diligence process runs as smooth as possible. Obviously, the buyers are going to engage in a thorough due diligence process to understand every aspect of the business that they can, legal, financial included. And the smoother that process runs, the better. You know, if there are hiccups in that process, and there often are, but if the more that there are, the more likely you are to chase that potential buyer away. You want to make that process run as smooth as possible. You know, it's almost like a first impression on a date. You know, when they look at your diligence, your books and records, they look at the policies and procedures you have in place, your internal controls relating to financial matters, and if those things are in order, it's an indication of how you run your business. And so, one of the first things to think about is just making sure that those things are in order. And then, you know, another thing I would mention, Will, is trying to understand really when the best opportunity is to sell your business, the best time to sell your business. You know, there's a lot of factors that go into that are specific to the business and that are more macroeconomic. You know, it may be that the business is not quite to the level of maturity that you want, where you think you can get the most out of it. But if you look at macroeconomic conditions, valuations are high, multiples are high, your industry maybe is particularly hot at the time, maybe that's the right time to exit. In other circumstances, you know, it may make more sense to stay behind the wheel a little bit longer, put some more money into it, maybe even do some acquisitions yourself to build in particular strengths that are strategic in nature. So, you know, there are a lot of things to consider in that regard. And from that perspective, that's really where it's beneficial to speak to an investment banker and get the benefit of their experience and their analysis, the financial analysis that they can lend to a company. And I would say, too, because I've been through this process many times, sometimes clients are reluctant to engage an investment banker because they're not inexpensive either. They take a fee that's generally based on a percentage of the transaction value, and that fee can range, you know, depending on the size of the deal. But let's say that fee ranges between 1.5% to, you know, 3 or 4%. That can add up in a significant size deal. And so the question is, would you get more value, net more value, you know, to the owner's pockets with the experience of a banker after paying his fees, or would you be better just selling it on your own? You may know your industry really well. You may know competitors in your space that are interested in purchasing your company. And on those occasions where there's strategic investors or strategic buyers involved, you know, maybe that's something you can do without the benefit of a banker and just using experienced legal counsel to help you through it. But I would say the majority of occasions, it's beneficial to at least talk to a couple and you know, get a couple of referrals to investment bankers, at least a couple of referrals to investment bankers that know your industry, get the benefits of their insight to the industry, where that industry is in its cycle as far as evaluations and multiples of EBITDA or revenue or whatever the metrics are for that space. So I think it's usually beneficial. And even in the end, if you don't engage them, you at least get the benefit of some of their experiences.
Well, now, you have clients, ongoing clients then, that are not just looking to move from entrepreneurial to exit.
Certainly.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. How do you see the business climate in Orange County, California, and the country right now for those companies?
Well, it's interesting. You know, a lot of the, I would say, we've done several financings recently that are characterized as recapitalizations, meaning that the usually the valuation is less than their prior round of financing, that the earlier investors are having to get crammed down to a smaller percentage of the company and give up a larger percentage of the company in the financing. And just because of the, you know, if you looked just at that as a metric, the number of recapitalization financings going on, I would say it's difficult. But at the same time, you know, there are still, there's still a fair amount of energy out there as far as new startups, and entrepreneurs in the county that are making efforts to build their companies and raise capital. I think it's I wouldn't say it's probably neutral. Locally, you know, it's probably a little bit better than nationally. But you know, as far as the business climate is concerned, but we also have the burdens. You know, California is an expensive place to do business. Regulations are difficult. California is extremely protective of employees, and has you know, policies, regulations that are protective of employees that make business sometimes a little bit more difficult to do. And taxes, obviously. Taxes are a huge issue here in California. And so, you know, there have been a fair number of companies that have moved to Texas or to Nevada for tax reasons. There are states in the country that are incentivizing companies to move their facilities there by getting tax benefits. So, you know, California has the advantage of having a great pool of human talent, but the burden of an expensive environment to conduct business. But we've, you know, we've got some of the best universities here. So as far as talent coming out of schools and talent coming out of other companies, other technology companies, it's, you know, it's, I would say it's close to unparalleled within the country. But the those other factors that make it a more expensive place to do business are having an impact.
Well, now, do you see? This afternoon we got some information about corporate assets. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, for the S&P 500 companies, there's corporate cash is like 28% of current assets. They're sitting on mountains of cash right now.
Right.
Is that true of local companies, medium to larger local companies?
I would say as a general trend, at least on the public side, it's hard to make generalizations, but yes,
right.
I would say that I don't think our local public companies are any different in that regard, except for the fact that, we only have a handful of really large, multi-billion-dollar in market cap public companies in Orange County. Mm-hmm. But as a general rule, yeah, that's accurate. They're sitting on a lot of cash. And I tell you what we do see as a result of that, back to our M&A discussion, is a lot of the sales that we're involved in, and a lot of on the purchasing side too, when we represent buyers, are mostly cash deals. They're mm-hmm. companies making strategic acquisitions with cash from their balance sheet. So they're often not levered deals, meaning they're not taking on additional debt to make the acquisitions. They're just using cash on their balance sheet to buy strategic assets. And so that's part of...
Yeah, sometimes they may have to take on the debt of the company they're acquiring, right?
Sure. That's part of it. To some extent, there's some... if you want to characterize that as leverage, there's some debt involved, but many times no, and many times the seller may not even have debt. It might be a relatively smaller company that was all financed through equity. Mm-hmm. But the byproduct of the fact that you just raised, with a lot of these corporations having a lot of cash on their balance sheet, is that they're acquisitive and using cash in their acquisitions. Which is a trend, I think, over the last several years. Prior to that time, when in particular when the private equity firms were even more active, you saw a lot of leverage deals. And then on the strategic side, because the private equity firms were levering their deals with credit, they were willing to pay oftentimes a higher price than some of the strategic buyers were. And so strategic mm-hmm. buyers were, having to use their stock as consideration in a lot of those deals. I mean, that's not the only reason why you do that, but in order to compete, they would do that. We're not seeing that quite as much. And part of that reason is because many corporations don't think their stock is fairly valued. And so they don't want to issue additional shares and have their existing shareholders suffer dilution
right.
at current market prices. So a better way of making those acquisitions is taking cash on their balance sheet that they're doing maybe nothing else with, and investors are looking for them to use the assets in a way that's most valuable to the shareholders, and just holding on to a bunch of cash is not that valuable, so they've got to put it to work. So, I think, a fair trend.
The places to put that cash, I mean, one is to acquire. Now, when you observe these cash-rich companies strategically acquiring other companies, is there do you see them consolidating and reducing headcount?
No, not necessarily. That is very facts dependent.
Mm-hmm, right.
On the target, and to the extent that there's overlap in responsibilities between the buyer and the target, and whether the target is has too many many employees, where there's room
right.
to pull some overhead expense out. But no, I would say for the most part that's not the reason for the acquisition, is just to simply save on overhead expenses and make the combined consolidated enterprise more profitable because of the synergies that they can extract. Most of the acquisitions we see are really more fundamental strategic acquisitions buying technology or, you know, buying maybe a distribution channel or, you know, buying something that's strategic to the existing business. Always they're going to look, obviously, at ways to extract some cost savings. But that, for the most part, we don't see, you know, as a model, at least in our experience, we don't see as a model, you know, just putting together a bunch of companies and getting rid of half of the employee base.
This is not 10 years ago M&A.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or even longer ago.
What else do you think is going to have to happen to get that cash out and active? Because when it's just sitting there, it's not helping the economy, is it?
No, that's right. I mean, there's, you know, the velocity of dollars. If it's just sitting there and on the balance sheet and not being put to work, it's not helping the economy. And that's the same argument that people use for the banks that have a lot of money and that aren't lending because they're being more conservative. You know, I don't know what's going to drive that. I mean, there's another tangential problem if you look at even some of the much larger companies like an Apple that have, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars that's sitting offshore or, you know, outside of the U.S. And because of the negative tax consequences of repatriating those dollars into the U.S., they're not spending that money in the U.S. But I don't, you know, that, well, as far as...
Well, tell me about that. I've heard that the money is offshore and can't come back on because there's tax consequences. Are those severe tax consequences, or are they normal business tax consequences?
Well, it depends. They could be cumulative tax consequences is the problem. You know, you're taxed possibly in the jurisdiction where that income was sourced. So if you're conducting business overseas somewhere and you're paying taxes on that income in that jurisdiction, and then you want to bring that money back into the U.S., and the U.S. wants to take, you know, a piece of it. And I'm not specifically familiar with the rates that would apply in that context, but it's not de minimis. It's significant. You know, that is obviously an impediment.
Okay.
That's, I mean, from a legislative standpoint, I think that's one of the things that I know some have, there's been a lot of commentary on whether that's appropriate or not and whether there should be some incentives to allow some of those companies to bring that money into the U.S. and put it to work.
Right,
For the same reason.
Not bring it back and just put it in their on their balance sheet.
Exactly. We've said from a macro perspective that the U.S. economy would be better off if those companies brought that money in, let's just even say hypothetically, without having to pay any tax on that money, if they put that money to work in the U.S. as opposed to them leaving the money outside of the U.S. because they don't want to pay taxes on it. You know, would the U.S. be better collecting taxes on the small amount of dollars that people, that those companies actually repatriate into the U.S.? Or would it be better if those companies brought all that money into the U.S. and actually put it to work? You know, you could certainly posit the argument that the latter would be a better scenario for the economy.
Yeah. It seems to me that really what we need to be looking at in business right now is, in addition to how is my business going to run better, it's how is business in general going to run? I mean, how is the economy going to get better? How are people going to get better, you know, have better lives? Because they took a... You know, we took a huge hit in the last 4 years.
Yeah, it's obviously a question I think that the country is struggling with at the moment, and how to do that, and, you know, whether that's through government involvement or through less government involvement. It sure is going to be interesting, you know, as we get more into the political season and the election to see what kind of proposals surface in that context. But I certainly wish I had an answer. Well,
I hope that we'll be able to vote on. Hopefully, we get to vote on proposals rather than who has the less mud thrown at them, huh?
Well, that would be nice. And just rhetoric for sure.
So now, are you seeing a pickup in employment with your clients? Are you seeing people hiring
across the board? Making a generalization, I wouldn't say that, you know, there's a an aggressive net positive trend in that regard. I would, because it really, again, it's probably more fact specific, and my experience with the particular clients is really dependent upon where that company is and its level of growth.
Uh-huh.
It would certainly be a net gain that there is hiring. There's more hiring than there is terminating. At least,
do you find that your clients are optimistic? I mean, if they're the entrepreneurial level, they have to be optimistic, or they would be insane,
well, that's,
right?
That's right. That's the primary characteristic of an entrepreneur. They're very optimistic and confident in what they're doing. I would say, yeah, as a general rule, at a minimum, you know, to use the term cautiously optimistic, but, you know, probably even more so than that, I think that, yeah, they're optimistic. I think everybody has the concerns about the more macro trends, but when you're looking at the earlier stage companies, and as we've talked to, we represent a lot of more mature public companies as well, but if you're just looking at the earlier stage companies, it's just their nature to be optimistic. So I would say the general sense would be yes, optimism prevails.
Are you seeing any expansion of manufacturing in California?
You know, frankly, Will, with the clients that we work with, most of them don't have their large manufacturing facilities. They're uh-huh. If they're technology based, they may have facilities outside of California or even outside of the U.S. There are, I actually do have a couple clients that have expanded some manufacturing facilities in California, but no, as a general trend, I would say it's the opposite. That as far from a manufacturing standpoint, in the number of companies that do manufacturing in California, that's probably a net decline.
Entrepreneurs, they do require manufacturing, right?
For sure. For sure. It all depends on the company.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're producing. But mm-hmm. a lot of, you know, if they're, for example, if they're a software company, you know, they've got a lot of R&D, they've got development teams, they're coders, and then mm-hmm. they just license the software on a subscription basis, you know, through a through an internet portal or, you know, mm-hmm. and host it either themselves or through a hosting service. You know, there's no manufacturing in that context. On the there are companies engaged in the, let's say, like in the medical device business, where there's a manufacturing of the devices themselves, or in the pharmaceutical space, where they have the processing of the actual pharmaceuticals.
Right.
So yeah, it's certainly a mix, but mm-hmm. you know, a lot of the clients that we work with in technology space don't have large manufacturing needs, and to the extent that they do, they also have the option of outsourcing that, at least at the earlier stages, and using that as an option as opposed to spending a lot of capital resources to building your own manufacturing facilities.
Right, right. Well, listen, this has been very interesting, Chris. What would you like to leave our listeners with?
I guess, you know, maybe just to summarize to where we start and to where we start our initial conversation, Will, is that, you know, Orange County is a very vibrant business community, and it's actually a fairly small business community, but there are a lot of resources in Orange County and a lot of people that are really actively engaged in further developing support of emerging growth businesses in Orange County, and you know, the more we can all do individually in that regard, the better we're all going to be from an economic standpoint, because it really builds on itself. And the more that we can make Orange County recognized as a center for entrepreneurship and for emerging growth successful companies, it's the better we're all going to be. So I guess that would be my parting thoughts.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. This has been very interesting, and I hope it's been winsome for folks who are thinking about starting something, thinking about taking the next step, and looking for somebody to walk alongside them with some experience.
Thank you very much, Will. I appreciate you having me on.
All right. Look forward to talking with you soon. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you have another insight into what's going on in business in Orange County in Southern California and the various stages that business are in, and a lot of enthusiasm for the entrepreneur, people who have ideas. And what Chris was saying is that there are funds out there available, and sometimes we have to take a look at a different way, different strategies for attracting that those funds. But there is money out there for people, and there are ideas that are important, significant, and have legs, frankly. What Straddling Yucca does, and I've seen them do it many times, is once they have a client and they work with that client, they help that client through the various stages and obstacles and help strategically to achieve the goals that the company has. So it's been fun to talk with Chris today. I look forward to talking with you next week as we continue to move up and down the 405 looking for CEOs and service partners who have lots to contribute to the economy and the well-being of people who live in Orange County. So this is the Pilgrim on the 405 wishing you and yours a happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and all the blessings of the season.